You're listening to Asheville FM at WSFM LP 103.3 Asheville. I'm news team correspondent Emma Hutchins, joined today in the studio by Martin Ramsey, candidate for Asheville mayor. Welcome, Martin.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. So this is our second round of candidate interviews. Congratulations on making it through the primary.
Thank you.
Yeah. And so we wanted to dive deeper this time to hearing about, you know, some of your stances on the most pressing issues that Asheville is facing. But first, I want to give you an opportunity to introduce yourself to our listeners again, in case they missed you the first time around.
All right. Well, my name is Martin Ramsey. I'm a service industry worker in town. I'm a socialist. I'm an activist in town. I like to garden, and I'm a father. So that's the short introduction of me, but I ran for mayor previously, 4 years ago, and have kind of continued writing and that sort of thing, agitating the media, as well as like working on some personal projects. And also my son was born shortly after the last race, so he's big now, or slightly big.
How long have you been in Asheville?
I've lived in Asheville for 10 years now. I moved up here in 2006, I believe, so a little more than 10 years. I moved to the Burton Street neighborhood, and then I lived in East Asheville for a little while, in Haw Creek. I've lived in downtown in Chicken Alley before they turned it all into short-term rentals, and I lived right next to Green Life on Maxwell Street, and now I live out in Beaver Dam behind the Ingalls over there. So with the exception of South Asheville, I've kind of like run the gambit.
What are your thoughts on maintaining a balance between development and tourism in Asheville and meeting the needs of Asheville's citizens to keep the city livable?
Well, I think that we need to take stock of kind of where we're at. We've been kind of pell-mell promoting the city as a tourist destination through the Buncombe County Tourist Development Authority and, you know, advertisement across the country and internationally even for quite some time now. And you can see the fruit. You know, there's like cranes all over the place. Hotels are popping up like crazy. Asheville's absolutely going through a development boom. And I think that we need to consider how much that's affecting the livability of the city. And it's put an incredible strain on the infrastructure of the city and the way that that is being dealt with in terms of city financing is by raising property taxes. And we are forbidden by state law from doing a differential tax rate or a progressive tax on property, which hamstrings the ability of the city to raise property taxes, because ultimately it means that the people who are on fixed incomes are going to be forced out, legacy homeowners. And you can see statistics that are really, you know, shocking, honestly, in studies like the State of Black Asheville on that effect in the minority community here in Asheville. It's just shrinking. And, you know, also the industries that are being brought here who are capitalizing on the boom are largely low wage and not providing a standard of living that is allowing people to live in a heavily gentrifying and expensive city to live in. Now, that has, you know, like profound effects, you know, just in terms of eviction and the suburbanization of poverty. But, you know, that also shows up in just how many cars are on the road, because people have to live outside of the city and then they drive into the city to work because this is where the work is. So it puts an extra burden in terms of traffic. We have a lot of compounding issues that are associated with this. And at any rate, you know, one thing that I think that we need to really consider is putting the brakes kind of onto this kind of development. And I would be personally highly skeptical of any sort of land or tax deals that are associated with bringing large businesses, a la New Belgium, the Linamar deals of the past. They just don't work when you bribe companies to relocate with the promise of however many jobs. You know, we're usually talking less than 200 jobs, and we're giving away an incredible amount of money or an incredible amount of future tax value for and often I feel like, you know, we're going to see investment in our city anyway. And then when and you've seen this happen across the country where when the window for benefits that municipalities have given to companies in order to entice them to come closes, they immediately return to the elected officials and are like, well, you know, if you would like us to stay here, we need to kind of continue this mutually beneficial relationship. And, you know, that's institutionalized extortion. And then you have larger businesses extorting the municipality for sweetheart deals. And that's like, you know, I've heard on the campaign trail, like, why don't we have like a BMW plant here like they have in upstate South Carolina? And they gave an incredible amount of money. The state government gave an incredible amount of money. The municipality in South Carolina gave them an incredible amount of money to get them there in the first place. And like, that's, I don't think that's a way forward, personally. With regards to development, you know, we have problems in terms of the fact that we should have, back when we were able to annex property into the city proper, we should have done that. We should have annexed Biltmore Forest and any number of other places involuntarily because they're transparently part of the Asheville metro area and they benefit from our services and they don't contribute to you know, our polity. And that has hamstrung our ability to grow out in any sort of cohesive way. So we need to grow up. You know, and I would be for, you know, density bonuses. And I think that, you know, even though it's going to make people who are worried about their view sheds, which is a weird term. I had never, ever heard the term view shed before I moved to Asheville. But, you know, people are going to be upset about that, unfortunately. You know, there's like a strong NIMBY streak in Asheville's politics, you know, where if you generally ask someone, well, you know, are you for like dense and affordable housing for working people in Asheville? And they're like, yeah. Over there, not where I am. And like, it's weird to see the opposition kind of cluster around wherever it's going to happen. And I think like places like Larchmont apartments and that sort of thing, who got a lot of resistance, but were moved forward with anyway, a lot of those fears haven't materialized. And so, you know, I think that Asheville is going to grow. It needs to grow up. And in a dense fashion, I would like to see a lot of that happen along the corridors that kind of make sense where there's like a little bit of land and like increases in density would make sense, like moving out on Broadway. I think that the idea of having, you know, as Merriman, you know, kind of like becomes more valuable and like they consider like redeveloping areas along that. I think that that needs to be rezoned for density, more density than there is, like less parking frontage, frankly, and more mixed use, and you know, apartments in neighborhoods like Montfort and Five Points, and that's going to be unpopular to some. But like, you can see the kind of effects of previous, you know, apartment building, and like, we don't consider that like out of the character of the neighborhood at all, like. The one that's right across the street from the Harris Teeter and Trader Joe's right now. It's a beautiful old apartment complex. And no one is like, oh, this is terrible, dense housing. You know, it's like five stories of apartments. And there's nothing wrong with that. And I think that we need to see more of that. But that would help alleviate traffic on our roads. And also, I think, makes for a nicer and more livable city. You know, just like being able to like walk around in your community. And if we don't allow those things to be built, then we're going to see the trend towards like moving people who can't pay exorbitant prices for our existing housing stock further outside the city. And all of this is going to continue to get worse, which frankly, I think we're going to see a little bit of that in the short term, no matter what. You know, redevelopment takes time, not like it doesn't immediately come into effect, which is part of the reason that I think I support a rental crisis fund, because it's something that could be done immediately as opposed to something that could be implemented that is, you know, going to take 4 or 5 years to bring like affordable apartments. A lot of the affordable housing development that's happened in Asheville, you know, is enticing private developers to build affordable housing units as a condition for the approval of their projects. And big projects like that take time to come online, and people need housing now. And so that's why I think, like I said, the Rental Housing Crisis Fund is something that could be instantly applied, or not, perhaps not instantly, but it has nowhere near the turnaround time of major building projects.
You've made your way well into our second question, which is what can be done to improve the problem of affordability in Asheville? Mm-hmm. And I see that you've addressed that very much so around zoning and the types of buildings that we prioritize to build here in town, as well as the relief fund and increasing density places for people to live. Are there other things that you would like to add to that?
I think that a lot of that stuff that I was talking about is either stopgap, like the rental crisis fund, or, you know, kind of supply side problem, which is we need to build more places for people to live and reduce the pressure, market pressure on prices. So what about the affordability in terms of what people are being paid? That's a different question. And I think that it's something that needs to be addressed. And I would like to see the city, A, maintain its living wage certification. And I feel that'll probably go up, and there's going to be pressure to drop that, you know, or just kind of ignore it as the cost of living inches up and not raise those wages. So I think that needs to be kept in mind. And then also I feel like there's an opportunity to use the kind of ambassadorial or bully pulpit role of the mayor's office or council seats to work with the Western North Carolina Labor Council to begin unionizing our hospitality sector. It needs to happen. If you look at places who are also in right-to-work states that have a heavy hospitality industry, you find spots like Las Vegas, for example. You know, they're a right-to-work state, and they have a really, really strong hospitality union there, which is well-organized, and it's keeping money from that sector in people's pockets and allowing them to live in their town. And it turns jobs that people associate with poverty or low-wage jobs into ones that you can live on. And that's not something that can be dictated from the mayor's office, but I think that it's like a huge lack in our city that a lot of working people would really benefit from. And I think moving forward on something like that would be a huge boon for myself and any number of people who are in a similar situation as me. So that's two things that I think that the mayor ought to be considering and doing, keeping it at the forefront. Also, all the city council candidates, honestly, should be considering how, because we're really hamstrung. I think that's one of the really frustrating things about going to a lot of these forums and talking to constituents and that sort of thing. They, you know, people ask like, well, you know, what can the city do? And it's very frustrating to lay out the constrained nature of municipal power in North Carolina. And folks will be like, oh, well, look over here, you know, what's happening in Seattle or Los Angeles, and the architecture of state power versus municipal power is very different. So, you know, a lot of the things that would really help us, progressive taxation on property, the ability to like mandate municipal wages within our municipality, on and on and on. Like what uneven economic regulations, like we're not even allowed to ask contractors who do city work to pay decent wages. We can't even prioritize that. And that's incredibly frustrating because the market dynamics have solutions that we've used historically, and those have been rendered illegal. And that puts us in a real bind, and where the transparently obvious thing to do has been taken away from us as an option. And I think that that means that elected officials need to be stumping for more community and workplace organizing, because obviously it's going to have to happen both in the halls of power. Changes will have to happen in there. And, but, you know, I don't think they're going to have as much legs if there's not mobilized community forces behind those efforts. And so that's what I'd like to see happen.
All right. What do you suggest Asheville do to regulate short-term rentals moving forward? And if you'd like to also speak to whether or not you see different parts of town having different needs and therefore needing to be regulated differently or not.
Well, this has been like a hot button issue, and it didn't surprise me that it became that way. It was weird how kind of quiet that this particular question was until about a week before the primary, and then everybody was like, wait, lots of money is being made off of this. Let's make sure we know where everyone stands on it. And while I am not necessarily opposed to people renting out rooms in their homes, if they're living on a fixed income and mortgage distressed and that sort of thing. However, whole home short-term rentals are a major, major problem. And a lot of them can operate and do operate in direct contradiction to the zoning laws, and the city's enforcement hasn't even kept up. So I just think that, A, the current laws that are on the books need to be beefed up, maybe increasing the fines to make them punitive to the point where running one is not profitable at all if you get caught. You're going to lose money if you get caught doing that. I think that's one of the only ways that we're going to be able to make it, you know, just paying a fine not being the cost of doing business. And as far as places like the RAD or the downtown business district allowing short-term rentals, this is kind of maps onto me also wanting to see a functional transportation system, a public transit system in town here. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me personally to look at the business districts like downtown, which is our major transit hub, or the RAD, which lies along major transit routes to the west side, and think we ought to be building a lot of housing that will only be rented to people who are driving into town. It doesn't make sense, because if why would we make the RAD a zone for short-term rentals or downtown? Because then people who want to make money are going to be like, well, what's the difference between that and Charlotte Street? Charlotte Street's a commercial corridor. It ought to be zoned similarly. They'll make the same argument about Merriman Avenue, and they'll make the same argument about Hendersonville. And if once you've accepted the logic that like the RAD ought to be that, it's easy to like make the leap, you know, to major commercial corridors and transit corridors all around the city. And I don't want to see a situation where whole home short-term rentals are the primary use of housing along our transit routes, because otherwise we're going to be just dumping money into a transit system that people aren't going to be using. And it's going to be and if it is functional, it will be functioning for people who don't live here. And it'll be a tourist trolley rather than a public transit system for working people in Asheville. And just as like a personal anecdote, where I used to live off of Spears Avenue, had multiple short-term rentals on that street. I saw an entire apartment building evict their tenants. My community garden that I was working on with several neighbors of mine was tagged as an amenity, as like a live like a local kind of thing, and like the little advertisement for one of the short-term rentals, which was just kind of irritating and insulting. Because if one of my neighbors had been like, oh, you mind if we walk through the garden and pick some of them, I would have been like, yeah, sure, because that's the point of it. It's like commodifying our efforts to know our neighbors and to work together, which was really irritating. And in addition to that, like my own home was geotagged incorrectly on the map for an adjacent short-term rental. And so we had people coming up in our driveway regularly and being like, well, where is this? Am I at the right place? And we're like, no, you're not at the right place. So, you know, I think that people have extremely valid concerns about living next to whole home short-term rentals. And there is just no way that someone working on the wages that you can make in this town as a month-to-month kind of working person that can compete with the amount of money that can be made renting short-term rental, whole home short-term rental to tourists. You just can't pay $8,000 a month in rent. You know, in 2 months, you're talking about two-thirds of your yearly salary. Like, you can't do it. And so unless we just want to helicopter all of the people to change the sheets in the hotels and wash the dishes in these restaurants in from Buncombe County, more so than we're already doing, whole home short-term rentals have to go. And I support making that a reality. I support curtailing them across the city. I don't think that the argument that there's this like super interesting actually article that I read recently in a well-known left-wing media outlet, CNBC, the business channel. But anyway, they were talking about hotels, and this is how like the argument about short-term rentals gets framed. They're like, oh, well, you know, these are small, like kind of mom and pop operations versus the hotel industry, which is a, you know, billion-dollar global industry. And that's a little surface because, you know, Airbnb is a $40 billion company. They are not small potatoes. But they're not wrong that the hotel industry is a $400 billion global industry. They are a big player. There's no denying that. And this article was talking about how hotels were investing in short-term rental-esque companies. They're mimicking and using short-term rental platform as part of their business model. And this makes complete sense if you think about any industry, right? If you have like a big player who, like an upstart, kind of starts taking away their market share, if you think that the hotel industry is going to just sit around on their hands and let the short-term rental market just take away a quarter of their market, you're probably kidding yourself. So what are they going to do? The first thing that they did was just lobby against it, you know, at the state level, which has had limited effect. The second thing that any business would try to do, which is in a big position like that, would be to try to undercut the price, but they can't do that because it costs more money to just operate a hotel in terms of energy costs, labor, construction, et cetera, than it does for someone to just rent out an existing property. So they can't undercut the price. They've had limited effect in terms of, you know, quashing it with like political favors. And so what are they going to do now? They're going to buy it or they're going to mimic it, which is always how these markets work. So unleashing STRs, ironically, even though people think that it's like sticking up for the little guy, is going to benefit hotels. Because if there's a dip in the tourist economy for whatever reason, and that's going to happen eventually, whether it's, you know, Donald Trump starting a war, whether it's, you know, oil availability problems, environmental catastrophe, economic collapse, whatever, it's going to be something. And the first thing that people are going to cut out in terms of their expenditures is leisure money. That's what I do in my house. That's what anybody does. You know, if you're like strapped for cash, the last thing that you're going to do is go and spend $2,000 traveling across the country to go on a vacation. So if we see a reduction in the amount of tourism dollars that are coming into the city, all of the people who are relying, all of the smaller businesses who are relying on this income stream for short-term rentals and that sort of thing, all of a sudden are going to be in a pinch. And then the bigger players, whether that's hoteliers who have set up short-term-esque operations, like the one that I described in CNBC, or just larger property management companies and multiple property holders who own, you know, 10, 20, 25 STR properties across the town, they'll be in the perfect position to take advantage of smaller businesses and individual homeowners' vulnerability and expand their footprint across the city. And so I think that this is a genie that just simply cannot be let out of the bottle. It's not going to benefit anyone in the long term. People want it to happen because it's going to make them a lot of money in the short term. But I think that public officials need to have the long-term health of the community in mind. That's your job. And I think that allowing short-term rentals free rein across the city is a really terrible idea.
What is your plan for improving transportation and accessibility for people in Asheville?
Well, I would like to see a fare free transit system. I'm happy to hear about a lot of the changes in the management company that have happened in the last year. That's been really important. The last one was abysmal. And I'm looking forward to improvements in the timeliness and customer service of the routes. That is a major factor in usability. People need to be able to rely on the transit system to get them where they need to go on time. You know, I mean, you have to make appointments. You can't be late regularly to work and not get fired. And if you're a person who regularly relies on transit in order to get to where you need to go, it needs to be timely. So I'm sensitive to the concerns about timeliness. But I do also feel like it's not an either or situation in terms of, can we make it fare free? And is that going to mean sacrificing, timely management of the system too? I would like to see both of those things happen. And I look forward to the new management company coming on. Like I said, I think that's going to improve a lot of those aspects of the system. And, you know, there needs to be some credit where credit is due to some of the members of the transit boards, the Multimodal Commission, Kim Roney and Calvin Allen and Justin Economics, who've been pressing on these issues for some time. And, they've been doing a lot of good work. And I think we're about to see the fruits of some of that. And I think we need to press our advantage on that, because just as an environmentalist, like, the bus system is not going to make money. So, like, looking at it like a business doesn't make any sense. You know, 91% of its funding comes from federal grant money. A very small percentage of it is actually made up via fares. And it costs money to take fares. To just like simply managing the cash that comes in is a cost in and of itself. And considering that's such a marginal amount of money, I would like to see, some way to frankly soak the people who are coming into park tourists traffic. We've got to figure out a way to use the parking fees that are associated with our booming tourist industry to subsidize public transit. And as a different thing, I would also really like to see a circulator, downtown circulators, was floated at a couple of the forums here. And I think that's a really good idea. We need to figure out, because transit's also associated with parking, right? You know, like the parking pressure on people that work downtown, you know, it's expensive. You know, if you're making $10 an hour, you know, you are giving up perhaps more than 10% of your income if you park there for more than 8 hours in one of those decks. And or, you know, you might be parking significantly far outside of downtown and, you know, walking by yourself late at night, possibly with money on you if you're in a cash business. It's a safety consideration, too. However, downtown property is super expensive, right? So, like, erecting, you know, more towers of parking isn't going to happen right away, but I'm also not sure that it makes a whole lot of economic sense to dedicate more space in the densest part of our city to parking. I think it makes more sense to me to figure out how to put parking on the outskirts of downtown and like have a trolley or a shuttle or a circulator system that, you know, is dedicated to getting people around downtown. I think that makes a lot of sense. So those are kind of like the highlights of what I would like to see happen. And I've been encouraged by the unanimity of the council candidates and both Mayor Manheimer and myself, actually, that this is recognized as an important thing. So I think that we're going to see, with, you know, some continued community pushes, some real gains in this. So I think that's just like a general bright spot, whoever is ultimately elected to council for this race.
So basically, Asheville in the last year has experienced several situations during which the Asheville Police Department was under scrutiny for use of force, for a police shooting and killing of a black man, Jerry Williams, and as well as for continued requests to expand budgeting to the department. So our question is, what strategies do you hope to employ to make sure that Asheville is upholding the best police practices possible and to improve police community relations?
I opposed the expansion of the police budget. I think that communities around our country have been asking for both community safety solutions, which usually come in the form of police in prisons, as well as when these questions kind of come up from the grassroots of the community, as well as asking for, you know, anti-recidivism programs, community development, education funding. And what they're getting, what they have gotten over several decades, is all police solutions and almost none of the social investment. And we have to begin to walk that back. There is not a good way, in my opinion, to use the police as a blunt instrument to deal with all of the social problems that are associated with, you know, underdevelopment, disinvestment in education, you know, economic insecurity, and that sort of thing. And addiction is another like big one. The opioid crisis is really like hitting a lot of people very close to home here. And there's using the police and incarceration to deal with these problems is, I don't think, a solution at all. Like, we live in a society that incarcerates more people than any other society on earth. And just as someone who considers themselves an advocate for a free society, that's a huge black eye on any society that considers itself free. And the police are the line number one of that system, that railroads people into a network of prisons, and that has to be grappled with. And I don't think that expanding them, giving them more tricked out cars or weapons or vests is ultimately going to deal with the problem. And that is a huge, huge long-term question. And I think that anybody who would advocate for using policing as a fix-all for these problems is gonna have to argue against me. I don't support that. But at the same time, I was really shocked, honestly, during the negotiations around the increase in the police budget, where the police chief wasn't even showing up to like meetings, to community meetings and that sort of thing, to advocate for increases in her own budget. And that's an imperious attitude, as far as I'm concerned. If you're going to ask for millions of dollars for, you know, people who literally carry guns and enforce the law, whatever you might think of it, in our community, and you can't bother to show up to meetings where questions are going to be asked of you, then the answer should categorically be no, as far as I'm concerned. You are responsible to elected officials, and the elected officials are responsible to the people. And if you can't take some time out of your day in order to answer those questions, then you don't really need that money that badly, as far as I'm concerned.
Are there communities that you feel can be better served by the city of Asheville?
Definitely. I absolutely think that we need to be looking at development, policing, any number of the questions that have come previously in this interview through the lens of racial equity. The state of Black Asheville is a shocking report, and it continues to be shocking. Like, the last iteration of it was showing all of these trends at the dwindling population of African Americans, the achievement gap in the schools, the lack of opportunity for Black young people and their flight to different urban environments because they don't see a future for themselves here at all. That's those are huge, huge red flags. And I think we need to, like, basically look at every political decision that we're making and say to ourselves, is this making these problems worse or better? Not any one thing that the municipal government is going to have or do is going to be able to address the structural or institutionalized racism of the American South and American urban places in general. But if we don't talk about it at all and don't consider it in our decisions, then it's absolutely going to just continue to get worse. And those communities have been neglected for a really, really long time. And I don't know. I think Shanika Smith has brought a lot of really important dialogue around that to the table this election cycle. And I would just like to see that. I would like to see that continue. Black Asheville has just been failed by the city government over the past few decades. It's not arguable. And now what we do about that moving forward is kind of a different question. And I think we need to keep an eagle eye on what's happening with the housing authority and potential redevelopment for Livingston and that sort of thing to just make sure that we don't see another wave of displacement. Like the last one. Yeah. The schools as well. It's such a profoundly, it's an issue that touches on so many different questions. And so I feel like the equity officer who's been appointed to the city is a good step in the right direction. However, would like to see that moved into a position that is accountable to elected officials instead of directly under the city manager, because her position, which I think is totally necessary, right now is subject to oversight via the city manager. And I feel like if you want an independent kind of like ombudsman around racial equity questions and someone who's going to look at different city policies and stuff that we're talking about implementing with regards to development, redevelopment, housing, education, et cetera, you don't want them to be worried about the internal bureaucracy of the city cracking down on them for doing what they've been asked to do. And so I feel like elevating that position to the level of the city clerk, the city attorney, and the city manager in terms of someone who's appointed directly by elected officials and accountable to them rather than the city manager proper would be a good step in that direction.
What is your position on the removal of local Confederate monuments and plaques?
They should be removed. I would just honestly like to see the plaques come off of the Vance Monument. I'd like to see the Robert E. Lee Memorial in the park there by the city building removed as well. They're leftover monuments to a Jim Crow era. They're not even Civil War monuments. They're like little altars of reaction to ascendant Black political power. They don't represent anything but that. And I think that it's one thing to talk about that in the context of a historical discussion, and it's another thing to venerate them in our public spaces, which is what they are right now. So, the city is forbidden to by state law from removing themselves. I wish that they had just stood down, that the police department had been ordered to stand down by the city council, and that Amy Cantrell and Nicole Townsend, some of the people who were attempting to remove the plaque, were just allowed to remove it. And then we should just say to the city government, you send your workers over here, replace these monuments if you so desire. We're not spending a dime on it. That's what I would personally do, and I would love to participate in one of those demonstrations myself.
How do you imagine the future of the Haywood Street property in downtown?
I personally think that a public space is what I would like to see there. I am skeptical of the idea of turning it just into a lawn. You know, I think that's a failure of imagination. It doesn't necessarily, I mean, because we spend a lot of money just like re-sodding McGuire Green. And there's I think a way to think about creating a genuinely public space that can be used. It's right across the street from a major entertainment venue. It's right across the street from, architectural and, religious institution right there in downtown, the Basilica. It makes sense to keep that in the public sphere. And also the value of the property, I think, ought to be lateraled into an effort for a community land trust. Because the equity that would be associated with such a piece of property could give some like buying and credit power, frankly, to an effort to remove land from the speculative market. I would like to see it used in that respect rather than, developed commercially, because we know what the highest bidders are in downtown. You know, if we put it out to market, we might get, $5 or $6 million for it. And then there's going to be a hotel on it. We all know that's what's going to happen. So we have a choice to sell it or not to sell it. And I think that we should not sell it. And also, I think there's a failure of imagination around transforming it into a park. Everyone's talking about how are we going to contract people to make this happen, blah, blah, blah. But if we're talking about making a public space, we actually have to include the public. We have to use volunteerism to transform the place. And like a few, gardeners and activists and old women have transformed a corner of that public space into, a garden. And, with a little bit of investment and community organizing and effort, I think that place could be transformed into something that we could be proud of and that could be not only held in common ownership, but whose land value could buttress other effects or other efforts to keep our city affordable.
Well, my last question is that on the ballot, in addition to voting for candidates, there is also a voter referendum asking Asheville residents if they support dividing the city into electoral districts. How do you think that this change will impact future elections?
Well, I don't support splitting us into districts. You know, I thought it was kind of an interesting political decision for the council to place it on the ballot because it sets us up for an interesting battle with Raleigh if we vote against the districts, which, like I said, I am going to do. I think that it's a transparent attempt to place conservative political voices on the council. And the success of Vijay Kapoor as a South Asheville candidate, no matter what you think of his politics, really puts the lie to this idea that, South Asheville Republicans just can't, I mean, maybe it's just that Ashevillians aren't going to come out en masse for Republicans no matter what. And that's going to require some sort of electoral chicanery to make that a reality. And that's what all of this is about. I'm concerned that if we are forced to implement a district system, especially the one that's designed by the state right now, what's going to happen is you're going to see the balkanization of different sections of the city in terms of, what are you going to do for my district kind of like attitude instead of kind of considering the whole of the city. And districts initially, rather than at large election, were used to address some of the effects of racial discrimination in electoral politics, to allow for black majority representation in certain districts. And that's why a lot of them were imposed in other places. And I think in that context, it makes sense. But if you look geographically across our city, you've got a pocket of African American population in Shiloh, and you've got some South Side, and you have some in Pisgah View, and they're the MLK kind of neighborhood, but there's not it's not concentrated in a way that other cities' geography is. And so I fear that by splitting all these things, we're going to see, you know, the organized kind of political expression of the Black community dwindle rather than be bolstered by this. It would have a reverse effect of what districting elections has historically been used for. So that's what I'm concerned about. That's why I'll be voting against it.
Well, thank you so much, Martin, for sitting down with us again. Again, I've been speaking with Martin Ramsey, who is running for mayor of Asheville this year.
Yeah, martinramsey.org is the website. November 7th is the election. Early voting is happening right now. If you're not registered to vote, the Board of Elections would be happy to help you out, register you, and vote you in one day. So get out there. And if you'd like to take a look at the website, please do. And I ask for your vote. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you.